Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 71 of Season 5 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is a very special guest, someone who actually lives close to where they filmed part of this movie in Denver. So welcome to the show, my good friend Todd Liebenow of the Forgotten Filmcast.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Great to have you. Great to have you. I know they changed the name of the airport since then, but still, you know, it's close.
Well, it's a totally different airport now. And, you know, watching this movie, I'm unclear as to what scenes were done at the old airport. The old airport was called Stapleton Airport or Stapleton International Airport. And they stopped using that about a few months after I moved here nearly 30 years ago. And since then, it's been Denver International Airport.
Maybe that's why they were able to actually film the movie there, because it wasn't being used as an airport. Is that possible?
No, it was being used. They might have been, I don't know if they had closed parts of it or what, getting ready, because the building of Denver International Airport, I know, was a long process. I mean, even once I moved here, it was well after when they had been planning on opening the airport and got delayed and delayed and delayed. The legend always going around was that it was the baggage system. They had this intricate automated sort of baggage system that sorted things and all that. And they kept putting test bags through it and they were coming out shredded. And
so like Cochran?
Yeah, actually. Yeah, you know, I when I was watching this the other night, I did as I was watching that scene, I was like, oh yeah, that could have been the baggage system at DIA. But yeah, no, I mean, things have been running smoothly now for nearly 30 years at Denver International Airport, and you know, it's for a long time it was I was very used to that place because I used to travel a lot for my job. I don't anymore. But I was in there every couple of weeks, so I used to know that airport very, very well.
Oh, wow. Okay, great. So Minute 71 begins with the pilot getting surprised, and it ends with a shot of a pilotless plane. So we ended things on Friday with, you know, Stewart pretending to be the tower and giving orders to FM-1. And the pilot responded that these are contrary to our orders. We're supposed to land on runway 1, where we are to be met by representatives of your Justice Department. And as he's talking, we can see in the background, Esperanza showing up, you know, with a gun in hand. And he starts talking to the captain and goes, "Captain, please tell the tower you will proceed as ordered." So, first of all, why is he speaking English? Don't you think he should have spoken to him in Spanish?
That's a good question. I mean Franco Nero, I mean, what is he Italian?
He's Italian, but he did speak to the corporal in Spanish.
Yeah, see, Franco Nero is one of those guys that plays all kinds of different ethnicities and various other things. When I think Franco Nero, I think he's in the first of the canon ninja movies, Enter the Ninja. And he's in a movie I covered on my podcast called The Visitor, where he plays this like Jesus-like figure. In fact, I think I had Jason Soto and Nolan on that show, and we started just by the end of the show, we were just referring to Franco Nero's character as Space Jesus, because that's basically what he is in that movie.
Interesting. I don't think I've ever seen that movie. I don't think I have any desire to see. Is it worth seeing?
The Visitor is worth seeing just because it's one of those where you'll watch it and go, I cannot believe that a movie this crazy ever got made.
Okay, so in other words, I'm not going to like it. the chances are slim.
It depends on your frame of mind, I guess.
That's true. So in other words, I should probably, you know, get a little drunk, smoke a little pot, you know, and all the things that I never have done in my life, seriously, and try to watch a movie about Space Jesus. Okay.
Nor have I. Even though, you know, pot is legal in Colorado and has been for some time, not something I'm I indulge in myself.
Yeah, I completely understand that. That makes a lot of sense. But wait, but does that mean you liked the movie when you saw it, even though you weren't on something at the time?
Well, like I said, The Visitor is all about frame of mind. So like is a
strong word. How did you get into the frame of mind? Maybe I'll ask it that way.
Let's just say I knew that it was a kind of notoriously crazy movie to start with. So I just was already in the right frame of mind.
Okay. For it. All right. That's fair. And come on, if you had Jason with you, so, you know, that makes it a little easier.
And I suppose you could say those, you know, those enhancing substances are just in the air out here in Colorado. I mean, certain places that you drive, I mean, you can smell it. I mean, my wife works right across the street from a building where they grow the stuff, and you can smell that thing. There's a section of town, you drive through it, and it's referred to as the Green Mile.
Ooh.
Because that's where all the pot shops are.
And there's no John Coffee there, you're saying?
No. Yeah.
Interesting.
No Mr. Jingles.
Nope. All right. That sounds interesting. So, yeah. Franco Nero. Yes, he's multiple. He has... in many movies, he's different ethnicities. The one that to me always stood out besides this movie with him in it is 21 Hours in Munich, where he plays, an Arab terrorist. So then again, you know, completely different ethnicity with him. But for me, this has always been the movie that I've seen him. You know, when I think of Franco Nero, the first thing I think of is Die Hard 2. So, but that's me. But and that's also probably one of the reasons why I'm doing this movie minute by minute. For some reason, it's the same reason that if someone were to say William Sadler, this is the first movie I would think of, not, you know, Bill and Ted or.
I think Bill and Ted.
Right. Okay. William I Sadler understand that. First. Most people do.
I think his performance as Death is just fantastic. And I like him in this movie. I think that he's solid. The problem is, and my son said this to me when we were watching this the other night, because I sat my son down. I was like, I got to rewatch Die Hard 2 for a podcast.
I got it? What do you mean,
and
gotta?
A long
I
time.
Want to. Well, you were not forced.
I've got a schedule. I was like, I'm recording these episodes. You know, we've got to watch this on Friday night. He was like, okay, all right. And part of that is because I've only ever watched Die Hard 1 with him. I've been meaning to get to the rest. I was like, okay, come on. This is the time. We got to watch Die Hard 2. And so we're watching it. When it was over, he said, you know, the bad guys in this movie weren't as good. And it's just like, well, yeah, but part of that is because you're comparing them to Alan Rickman.
That's right.
You know what I mean? William Sadler has this, and Franco Nero, they have the unenviable task of coming between Alan Rickman and Jeremy Correct. Irons. Who wants that job, really? I mean,
well, apparently William Sadler did, but you know,
yeah,
you know, that's why Jay loves him, because he gets to talk about the naked Tai Chi. But you know, that's just
yes. I think that's the thing I remember most about.
Well, I think that's supposed to be one of the most memorable things you think of about this guy. You know, but so as Esperanza is speaking, you know, we see the co-pilot starts looking on with a very worried face, and he sort of shakes his head slightly, sort of, you know, motioning to the pilot something, you know, and Esperanza obviously just wants them to comply. Now, it's also interesting that he just holds the gun on the pilot, you know, and doesn't even try to, you know, to also somehow cover the co-pilot. You know, at the same time,
I guess it's kind of like the philosophy of, you know, if you're a terrorist and you've got the president and the vice president there, who are you going to point the gun at? Right.
Yeah. But as soon as you shoot the president,
nobody cares about.
But
the
as
vice
soon as you
right?
shoot the president, the vice president becomes president. So you've created a monster.
Well, that's when you move the gun, I guess.
You have to be very quick, I guess, you know, but yeah. And then the captain then looks back at the co-pilot. And the two of them look back at each other, and you can see in their eyes that they're debating what to do. And this is like a great point in the movie where they just change the music and they give us this really tense music. You know, like these two people have these very, you know, definitive decisions that they need to make. Because what are they going to do? Are they going to listen to this terrorist that somehow, you know, overpowered the corporal in the back, or, you know, try and do something? And then we see the captain just makes a quick decision, and he goes, Roger, dos, proceeding to runway 15. And then,
which that line always throws me because it sounds like, at least to my ears, it sounds like he says Dallas and not Dallas.
You're not the first person to say this.
Confused me when I was.
You're not the first person on this podcast to say that they've been confused between Dallas and Dallas. So you know you're in good company.
Oh, yeah, I used to, before I actually flew through Dulles Airport, I used to get the two mixed up just because people say the name and I'm like, Dallas, what, Washington D.C. Dallas? That doesn't make sense. But yeah, Dulles Airport. My apologies to the folks at Dulles Airport, but in all of my travels, I've been in hundreds of different airports, but it was always miserable flying into Dulles Airport. I thought it was one of the most poorly run airports I'd ever.
Well, come on, you got Trudeau there. What do you expect? And Lorenzo. you should have expected for something a little better. Yeah, I don't know. and then while the pilot is speaking, you see him once again eye the co-pilot, and the co-pilot then moves into action to try and disarm Esperanza. But what's funny is you don't even see the co-pilot take off his seatbelt when he's trying to do that. He just jumps up and I guess maybe the pilot and co-pilot are flying without seatbelts because of the way that they do this. We'll see a little later.
I suppose it's possible. Aren't there I'm trying to think what comedian, but I'm pretty sure I've heard a comedy routine of, basically saying, what's the point of a seatbelt on an airplane anyway? Because, if you crash, it's pretty much not going to do a whole lot for you.
Right, that's true. That's true. And also the way that the co-pilot grabs the gun, he grabs the gun and has it pointed at himself, instead of trying to point it away from himself. He pulls it because the gun is on the pilot and he grabs it. Maybe it's the same type of thing you were saying about the president and vice president. The vice president is pointing the gun away from the president.
Well, that's the thing that's always gone through my head in scenes like this, because there's always, there's a million movies where someone grabs the gun and they're trying to move it away. But, I always go, well, if I was in that situation, what would I do? I think I would probably be having trouble trying to make sure that the barrel of the gun didn't end up pointed at my face.
Well, that's the problem that a lot of these people have. And we see that the pilot is struggling to hold the plane on course at this time also, which, It also makes you wonder, why is he, having trouble now? Was it that the two of them had to hold on to the plane because of the storm outside? But you don't see them struggling beforehand. But then the pilot has to deal with it himself. It's not as if, the actual fact that they're trying to stop Esperanza, should change the amount of pressure on the inside of holding this plane up. Or whatever it is. In a few seconds, I can understand why that would happen. But for now, it's not. Then we see an external shot of the plane, and it shows the plane wobbling a little bit, which is something you'd think that you'd see in airplane or something like that. I don't think that that's very realistic, that the plane would start moving, would be swaying side to side because of everything that's going on here.
I don't know. I guess it depends. I've certainly been on plenty of planes that wobble.
You think they wobbled like this? It looks like they're, waving, the thing with both sides of the plane.
The only time I can think of, I was on one like that. I had a flight. It was so ridiculous because I was flying from Colorado Springs to Denver, which is only 60 miles. So it's the shortest flight I've ever been on in my life. And so you're flying right along the front range of the mountains, and it was a particularly windy day that day, and the wind was coming right over the mountains, and we were bobbing along
Were you in a normal-sized plane, or was it a small plane?
It was we were in the water. This was a full-size, United Airlines
plane. Isn't it easier to drive?
it was, but, the type of thing where you're flying from one location and it took you here and then it's got to take you there. And I don't remember the science of it. I remember this. It was because the guy that I worked for, he was always getting deals on flights and stuff. And so United was matching the price of another airline. But to do that, we had to go through Colorado Springs. because the other airline was based in Colorado Springs. It was an airline that doesn't exist anymore. It was, I think it was called like Western Pacific Airlines. And the only thing I remember about them was they painted one of their planes with the Simpsons characters once. And it was always like, ooh, do we get to fly on the Simpsons plane? But
well, yeah, that's good for you. I'm sure you'd rather the Muppets, but Simpsons is still good for you.
Yes. No, I'd much rather fly on the Muppets plane, though. That would be kind of scary because, you know, like typically, you know, when you see like the control room type of stuff when it comes to the Muppets, like, you know, in the Muppet movie, the projection room, it's the Swedish chef running the projector and he's going, oh, the blip, 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 and all, and it's like, you know, wouldn't want the Swedish chef flying the plane.
I can understand that, tower, that concern. Yeah. Then the plane for sure would be wobbling like it does here. You know, maybe mm-hmm. the pilot here is the Swedish chef in disguise.
Well, that goes back to our original question about what language they're speaking. That takes us into a whole nother dimension here, Rob.
That's right. No, I mean, like, I understand why the pilot is answering on the radio in English. That makes sense. But, you know, why he talks to Esperanza and Esperanza talks to him in English, I guess it's for us.
Yes.
You know, I'm sure you've heard the old joke, you know, what do you call someone who speaks three languages? Trilingual. What do you call someone who speaks two languages? Bilingual. What do you call someone who speaks one language? American. that's the way we are. What can I tell you? Mm-hmm. So we see the co-pilot, you know, struggling. At certain point, it looks like he might have the upper hand, but then the gun goes off. And, you know, good shot. He kills him in one shot. And then the second shot takes out the window. But if you notice, he doesn't raise the gun at all. It's like two successive shots, one after the mm-hmm. other, in the same direction. And it's downward, you know, towards his stomach, basically. So I don't really know how that happens.
Maybe a movie magic. Shade off
it's a magic bullet. No, but the seatbelt's behind him because he's not wearing it. So I don't know.
But this raises a question for me because, I know nothing about the science of this. I have never been on an airplane where a window gets shot out, nor do I ever want to be. But it's always portrayed in movies that, like, you blast out a window and then suddenly everything starts getting sucked out of the window. It's very dramatic.
And that we will get there. We will get there. We will get there. Patience, patience, patience.
All right. Mythbusters. Okay. I'm waiting for.
We're going to get there. We are definitely going to get. You want to talk about that now, or should we wait until we finish talking about the minute? What do you
want? No, it's your show, man. You do what you want.
All right. So after we hear this shot, so then the shot changes, and, you know, we see them in the church, and, you know, Stewart and Thompson, you know, react because this like really loud sound is, you know, they hear this loud screeching sound, you know, in their earpieces. Then we see Miller turn around, and then we see Garber, who's actually listening attentively. Garber isn't fazed by it at all. And then we get another shot of Trudeau, you know, him getting a little confused about the whole thing. Then we just hear like this loud static. And then Stewart quickly responds and goes, Foxtrot Michael One, come in, please. But he doesn't get a response. And then the pilot looks over at Esperanza and, as we said before, speaks to him in English and says, what are you going to do now? You're going to shoot me? So who will fly the plane? And now, you know, it's pretty interesting because here the pilot makes a very big assumption that, you know, this military leader of his country, you know, doesn't know how to fly. You'd think... Mm-hmm. I mean, it could go either way. You know, there are military leaders who know how to fly, and there are those who don't. Okay, but his assumption is that for sure this guy doesn't know how to fly, and therefore he needs him. And, you know, it's a little bit of a problem for him because, you know, the response he gets from Esperanza is, don't worry about it. It's not your problem, which is actually a great response because basically, you know, you're dead. You're not going to worry about it at all.
I guess you'd kind of think he might know if he was a pilot or not. I mean, because
maybe he has wings. Maybe he has wings on his military, you know, the military metals and stuff like that. He'd have like wings that he knows how to fly. I don't know.
But I mean, I wouldn't necessarily assume that any military leader would. I guess it would depend on what branch of the military they were in, or a leader for that matter. I mean, like, I was going through it in my mind when you were thinking or saying that, and I thought, I mean, like, thinking of our own presidents and stuff, the first came to mind, I'm pretty sure George Bush was a pilot.
Yes, he was.
That's all I can think of.
Both George Bushes were pilots, actually. But the father and the son were both pilots. So if they were in this situation, they would be able to deal with this. And just like Harrison Ford, in Air Force One. Reagan.
And Bill Pullman in Independence.
And Bill Pullman, right. But then the question is how many of the others were in the military. And I mean, like, Eisenhower was in the military, but he was, a ground, commander.
And Grant was, he was totally a pilot.
Well, right. I was going to say that if you go back far enough, most of them didn't even know what a plane is. So, yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, JFK was a pilot. No, sorry, JFK. Wait, was JFK?
He was on a boat.
DT-109. No, he was on a boat. Yeah. His brother was a pilot. The question is, I wonder if he knew how to fly. Not that would have helped him either. But, I'm not sure about that. But you're right. It all depends on what type of, from what branch of service the commander is from. But we don't know about that about Esperanza. So, but the idea that he automatically assumes, it's a very strange comment for the pilot to say something like that, basically saying, you need me. And the answer is no, I don't.
Right.
And that's it. And we see like a lot of like ice and snow flying around in the cockpit, which we'll get to in a second. And then Esperanza very easily pulls him out of the seat. Again, no seatbelt. And just throws his body on the ground. And then the shot goes back to Stuart, who is still concerned. And once again says, Michael 1, do you copy? And you can hear concern in his voice, because he basically is saying to himself, what did I get myself into? This guy's going to crash and, nothing's going to happen. I'm not going to be able to do anything here and stuff like that. And then
he had everything very carefully planned, and now it's not going the way he
thought
it
would. And this you can't even blame on McClane.
Right.
This is, I guess, Esperanza's stupidity, the way that he did this. Shooting off a gun in a plane. Don't know.
Yeah, you don't do that. Don't do that.
And then the minute finishes off with a shot of the plane in the air. Once again, wobbling a little bit, because now there's no pilot, as opposed to a pilot trying to hold on to the stick.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Now, on the commentary, it's very interesting that Rennie Harlan mentions that these scenes in the cockpit were the last ones that were filmed. And they filmed them in April of 1990. And he said that the and the movie came out in July, so we're just talking 2.5 months later.
Yeah.
And he was talking about the fact that he was under so much pressure to get the movie in, because he was also working on Fort Fairlane at the same time and stuff like that. And he just remembers that these scenes were the final scenes of the movie, and it was all done on a soundstage, obviously. It wasn't done in a real plane flying with a bullet hole in the windshield. So let's move back a little bit and go back to what we were talking about, what we mentioned a little bit earlier. Okay, what do you know about cabin pressurization in an airplane?
Nothing, except that it's a thing.
Okay, so anyone who's been on an airplane knows that they always talk about the fact that the cabin has been pressurized, right? So the pressurization, it's a process in which conditioned air is pumped into the cabin of an aircraft or a spacecraft in order to create a safe and comfortable environment for humans flying at higher altitudes. For aircraft, the air is usually bled off from the gas turbine engines at the compressor stage. And for spacecraft, it's carried in high pressure, often cryogenic tanks. The air is cooled, humidified, and mixed with recirculated air by one or more environmental control systems before it is distributed to the cabin. So basically the idea is to, give you enough air in the airplane that you feel that you're that you're not at a high altitude. We all know that if you go climbing or if you go to Peru and stuff like that, they say, or probably even close to you in the Rockies, you know, if you get high enough, they say, you know, the air is thinner the higher you get, stuff like that. And
Oh, yeah.
obviously, when you're in an airplane, it's going to be even higher, and that's even more dangerous. So when do you think they started creating pressurization systems in airplanes? Okay. They started flying around 1910, a little before. You know, when do you think people started realizing that, wait a second, if we want to go higher, we need to have pressurized cabins?
Boy, I don't know, but I mean, I'm thinking maybe following the war, the World War II era, something like that.
Okay, so you're sort of right with that. I'll give you a little bit of, I'll give you half a point for that one. So they started creating pressurized systems in the 20s and 30s, but only in the 40s were commercial aircrafts
Sure.
created with pressurized cabins and stuff like that. Usually, if you're flying over 10,000 feet, that's when you need to start having some sort of pressurization. And the adverse effects that you can have is there's a whole bunch of different physiological problems that can be caused by the low air pressure on the outside. So some of the things that that can happen to you can get hypoxia, okay, which basically means you don't have enough oxygen going from your lungs to your brain. You can get what's known as altitude sickness, which you know, basically you'll start hyperventilating, and you know that also will cause, you know, a lot of fatigue, nausea, headaches, sleepiness, and they can even cause pulmonary edemas. Then what you have also is what's related to what we're talking about here is decompression sickness, right? Which is basically bubbles in the bloodstream, which can cause severe problems. And then you have what's known as barotrauma, which is the fact that you get like pain in your ears, in like your middle ear, or in your stomach, and sometimes even on your teeth, because of the way that you know there's the lack of pressure. Now in spacecraft it's a little different, because the Russians would actually use a mixture of nitrogen and oxygen for their aircraft, and then for the US in the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo spacecraft they used 100% pure oxygen, which unfortunately is what caused the problem that, you know, the three Apollo 1 astronauts were killed in the
Oh
test on
yeah.
the ground, because they were using 100% oxygen on the ground. After that, they started using nitrogen oxygen mixes when they were doing it on the ground, but in space they continued using the 100% oxygen. All right, so now we'll get to the whole idea of the myths. Okay, so first of all, you know, we have what's known as explosive decompression and rapid decompression. Explosive decompression, something that occurs in less than 0.1 to 0.5 seconds. You have a change in cabin pressure that's faster than your lungs can actually, you know, decompress. And when this happens, you can get lung trauma. And obviously, there's the danger of unsecured objects that are going to become projectiles because of the explosive force, which they can liken to a bomb detonation. All right, this is why many military pilots, you know, you see in movies and stuff like that they have oxygen masks on for that very reason, so that they don't have to worry about any type of explosive decompression. And then you have rapid decompression, which takes longer, and you still have the risk of lung damage. But it's less of a risk than what you would have in an explosive decompression. There are actually only two cases that were con that two confirmed cases of people being sucked out of airplanes, you know, because of decompression. I mean, we see in movies that it happens all the time. You know, in movies it's very, you know, someone, you know, you'd think that the hole here that we see in the windshield will you know, have someone get sucked out, but that doesn't happen in at least not here. And so there's only been two cases of it. And the first one happened in 1973, where one of the engines on a plane broke off and struck a window And the passenger who was sitting at that window got sucked out, even though people were trying to hold him in. And they ended up finding the body 2 years later. You know,
Jeez.
they it took a really long time before they found that body, right? Then the second incident that happened was on April 17th, 2018, where there was a Southwest Airlines flight which also had the same issue, where there was a engine that was partially blown through the window, and a woman was sucked through, but only halfway, and the passengers were able to actually pull her back inside, but because of all the injuries that she received from it, she didn't make it in the end. And in both of those cases, those were the only people that were killed in the actual incident. Now, you mentioned Mythbusters, right? So then the question is okay, it will a bullet hole in a window actually cause explosive decompression? So in 2004, Mythbusters examined whether explosive decompression occurs when a bullet is fired through the fuselage of an airplane by way of several tests using a decommissioned pressurized DC-9. And what they found was it that one shot did not have any effect, and it took actual explosives in order to cause explosive decompression. Okay, meaning that basically the planes are designed so that people will not be blown out because of that.
Well, hopefully.
Yeah,
I would
exactly.
hope so.
That's right. And then we have other myths in movies about what happens when you are decompressioned. You have the sci-fi ones where people are on different planets and stuff like that, and they basically explode. A perfect example of that is Total Recall or Outland. You know, that when people are outside, then their bodies will start boiling and eventually explode. According to what scientists believe, that will not actually happen. You basically will just run out of air really quickly and die. You know, I don't think it's I think it's more what we see in the Guardians of the Galaxy, where people are just floating around in space.
Oh, yeah, they become popsicles.
Yes. And then we talked before about barotrauma, which is mostly related to the bends, going too fast up, climbing too fast up from the decompression from a lower level of the ocean. So there are two movies that actually show fictional accounts of what would happen. So one of them is Deep Star Six, which you might have seen because it probably maybe that's a
I've seen it.
forgotten maybe that's a forgotten film from 1989, if I remember correctly. Isn't that that's the one with Peter Weller, isn't it? Or is that
I
I
was gonna
think
say, I
so.
think is Leviathan the one with Peter Weller?
Oh, maybe.
There were three movies that were all like kind of deep sea horror sci-fi-ish type of things. Of course, The Abyss was the big one, and then Leviathan and Deep Star Six, all right in that same kind of time frame.
Right. Okay. So Leviathan was Peter Weller.
I think that's right.
Yeah. This one was Greg Evigan, and Miguel
Actually,
Ferrer was
I
there.
have a
Matt
poster.
McCoy.
I have a poster for Deep Star Six somewhere here in my basement. I used to, I would go to the video store and buy all their posters for $1 each when they were done with them, and I'd pick up everything. And so, yeah, I think I'm pretty sure I've got still got a Deep Star Six poster down here. It's cool. It's got this big scuba suit ripped in half
Yes.
on the poster.
Yeah. And do you know what the other movie is that shows what happens when someone is decompressed too quickly? Any guess? It's from
Are we
1989.
thinking of License to
You
Kill?
are thinking correctly.
License to Kill?
Yes, License to Kill, James Bond. You know, when
Yeah, Anthony
Anthony
Zerbe.
Zerbe. Yeah, that's right. When they put him in a decompression chamber with all the money that they think he stole, and then Robert Davi, from Die Hard 1, breaks the pipe. It cuts the pipe with an axe.
You've got both Agent Johnsons. Both
That's right.
Agent Johnsons are in License to
That's
Kill.
right. No relation. And then Anthony
One's a good
Zerbe.
guy, one's a bad guy in License to
That's
Kill.
right. And then Anthony Zerbe just explodes, and then he tells him to go clean the money, go launder it. So yeah.
I've always thought that is one of the I mean, maybe even the worst death in the whole James Bond series.
It's very
possible. That one and Kananga in Live and Let Die are right up there, one and two, I think.
True. That's true. And wasn't it, when we were talking about someone being sucked out of an airplane, wasn't Goldfinger sucked out of the airplane? Yeah.
Oh, you might be right.
He was.
I'm trying to remember.
You don't have to remember. I remember. Yes, Goldfinger was there. All right. So, yeah, that's what we have about decompressions and cabin pressure and stuff like that. So, Todd, do you have anything else for this minute before we get into the script?
I was going to throw out just how red this scene is. You know, the scenes on the airplane, in the airplane cockpit, are so red, which is kind of appropriate given Franco Nero, because, you know, Franco Nero has certainly been in more than his fair share of, you know, Italian, giallo, that type of film. And, you know, interesting colored lighting is a hallmark of those type of films. So yeah, it's kind of appropriate.
Okay, that's fair. All right, so the script is pretty much the same. There's a few slight discrepancies. So it says that the pilot, as he's talking, stops. He sees Esperanza, who has come into the cockpit holding the corporal's pistol. And then the dialogue is exactly the same. And then it says, suddenly the co-pilot leaps for Esperanza. Esperanza whirls, shoots twice. One shot kills him, but one shatters one of the side window panels. And wind and snow thunder inside like a wall. Then it goes to the traffic control and it says, everyone has reacted to the shot and noise, and now another shot. And then it goes back to Esperanza's plane and it says, tilt up from the pilot's body on the floor, already flecked with snow. So, you know, there's no dialogue there about what are you going to do? You know, how are you going to fly the plane without me? So every Monday we have a segment called McLean Monday, where my guests will give their top five Bruce Willis performances. So what have you got for us, Todd? Start with your number five and work your way up.
Okay. This was very tough.
I don't make these easy.
Number five, I went with, number five, I went with Pulp Fiction. Number four, The Fifth Element. I really enjoy The Fifth Element. Number three, Unbreakable. Number two, Armageddon. I think it's just such a classic Bruce Willis type of role. And then number one, you said I could only pick one Die Hard. So I just said the original Die Hard. But I mean, for me, it's kind of the whole
story. What, even five? So, you would put five on that list?
Well, no. But I mean, I'd put definitely one, definitely three. I mean, I probably would have had three somewhere here, you know, if I could pick more than one Die Hard. So one and three, definitely. And two is
okay. Close. So I should be happy that I stopped you from doing that. Give a little more diversity.
Yeah, no, five would not have.
Exactly. All right. Great. So, Todd, why don't you tell people where they can find Todd Liebenow?
Well, my blog and my podcast, you can find those things over at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. The podcast, we're releasing episodes pretty much every week. We always cover a film that is kind of off the radar, the type of film that people don't talk about anymore. So, yeah, check those out. I'm on Twitter at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. So, yeah. Come check out my stuff.
All right. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe to any podcast you might be using to listen to the show. You can find me very simply just by doing a search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, or you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little village,